Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you to the IATF Common Audit Report application, or CARA, and remote auditing presentation. My name is Joseph Krolikowski. I am a veto power reviewer for Perry Johnson Registrars. Now, our presentation today, it's a two-part presentation. We're going to start with CARA. We're going to go over what CARA is, how it works, how CARA impacts the audit process, the impact that it will have on you as an auditee. And from there, we're going to transition into IATF remote auditing. We're going to address policies on remote auditing, how you qualify for a remote audit, what technology test session is all about, what happens if things go wrong, a couple of other items therein. I'll have a couple of concluding remarks, and then we will take your questions. So let's begin with CARA. CARA, again, which stands for Common Audit Report Application. This was released back in fall of last year, and it is a means of ensuring consistency in the completion and reporting of the IATF audit process. Now, CARA, the way it's been formatted, it does include all of the major audit types, stage one, stage two, surveillances, recertification, even special audits. CARA also now has the capability for certification bodies to issue what we call ad hoc nonconformances. So if, for example, you have an issue where you have an underperforming scorecard, PJR is obligated to issue a special major nonconformance that's written into the rules. CARA supports that functionality as well. Now, in terms of what CARA is, when it was being developed, there was some speculation at that time that it would resemble the OASIS database that's used by the by the aerospace industry. Now, ultimately, that is not what we got. CARA is not a database, and I think that's a very important point that we need to emphasize here. It is not a shared database. You need to think of CARA as a tool. It is an audit reporting tool, and so the things that we're going to be walking you through today are facilitated by the exchange of a particular file type. We'll cover what that is in just a few slides here. So every IATF auditor, every certification body, they are all given unique credentials to access CARA and to create content. Now that content resides on the user's web browser. And that is where it lives until it is outputted in one or more of the possible formats. And as I said, I'll be giving you a little bit of clarification on that in just a couple of slides. Now, you may be wondering, well, is the audit process any different under CARA? And the answer to that essentially is no. The intent behind the people that created CARA, and certainly our intent as a certification body, is we don't want this audit process to suddenly feel different. About the only change that we feel you should be aware of is that your auditors are now permitted to have a little bit more report writing time. Previously, they could do up to 10%. Now, under CARA, they can take up to 15% of their on-site time. So obviously, depending on the number of audit days, that can be quite a chunk of time. But the auditors almost universally are telling us that CARA is a lot more time consuming in terms of the data entry. We're hoping, obviously, as it matures, as auditors get more used to it, that time will be reduced. Now, obviously, the big change for you, our clients, is going to be in responding to nonconformances. Now, as I mentioned, the audit process itself is going to feel exactly the same. The process of responding to nonconformances has been dramatically changed. Now, previously, you were accustomed to receiving a Microsoft Word file. This would come email, flash drive, what have you. You would fill in the document, send it back to your auditor with your evidence attached. Now, under CARA, the principles are the same. You're still going to get something from the auditor, but the mechanics have been changed. So let's go over that process now, step by step. So the first step, obviously, is you have to get the nonconformances from the auditor. And the auditor will prepare those nonconformances within the CARA application. And they will, again, through email or flash drive, they will give those to you in a format that is called a JSON file, J-S-O-N file. Now, depending on the number of nonconformances that were written, the auditor may give you a single JSON file, or if you have a lot of nonconformances and you have a number of team members, you can request multiple JSON files, one for each nonconformance. It can be done both ways. Now, the JSON file itself can't be opened. It can't be manipulated outside of CARA. If you attempt to double-click on it, for example, you're going to get an error message. So in the picture here, I've shown you an example of how this might look. You'll get an email from your auditor, and the JSON file will be attached. Now, what you do with that JSON file is you begin by going to the client CARA website, and I've provided the URL here. That's nc-cara.ietfglobaloversight.org. Now, once you're on that page, you will click the Load Report Backup button. That's at the bottom of the page, and you will load the JSON file that your auditor provided you. Now, once the JSON file has been loaded, you'll be able to respond to the nonconformances, and you'll do that by clicking the Edit icon. As you can see, I've got it pointed out here on the right-hand side of the screen. Now, once you've clicked Edit, you'll be able to review the auditor's nonconformance. This will have the statement of the nonconformance, the evidence that they're citing, the requirement that they're citing, things that you're accustomed to seeing when you get a nonconformance report. Now, if any part of what has been documented is inaccurate or misconstrued, it's imperative that you notify your auditor as soon as possible. You have to remember, auditors are human, and sometimes things can get garbled between the audit and the writing of the nonconformance. Now, if the auditor has their facts straight, but you just don't agree with the nonconformance, remember that you have up to 15 calendar days from the end of the audit to file a dispute with PJR. And we do provide a quick turnaround on any disputed nonconformances. Now, from there, assuming that the nonconformance is understood and agreed to, you are required to provide the following for your response. To begin with, your correction. Now, some folks refer to this as containment. This needs to include timing and responsible party. So, obviously, this is the action that you are taking against the evidence statement. You know, if the auditor found that there was an uncalibrated gauge, well, the correction is going to be to calibrate the gauge. Now, your response needs to include extent analysis. You need to give us every assurance that all similar situations were also addressed. Also, they talk about evidence of implementation. There's a separate tab for that. Now, what this needs to be is a reference to any related document numbers, training records, etc., that apply to the correction.
There's going to be a second evidence of implementation field for corrective action. Now, please note that this is not the actual evidence items itself. It's a description. The intent behind having you describe the evidence that you're providing is to ease the auditor's review of these items. Now, I'll be pointing out to you where the actual evidence needs to go in just a couple of slides here. Now, the next four items all pertain to root cause. The first of these is root cause analysis. Now, this is actually a new item in spite of the name. It's actually not intended to show the root cause result, but the analysis of the cause. Additionally, if you have, for example, a fishbone diagram or a root cause checklist or something that you used to perform the cause analysis, that can be attached under root cause analysis files. That is optional, of course. Your ultimate root cause should be documented under the field entitled root cause result. This is going to be the final established cause or causes for the cited issue. And again, there is a separate space for you to provide any files associated with that root cause result. Again, the files are optional in this particular step. Now, from there, we begin with corrective action. The field is entitled systemic corrective action. And just like before with the correction, you need to specify timing and responsible persons. There is a space, again, for you to provide evidence of implementation. This is where you're going to, again, describe the evidence that you are providing and correlate it to your corrective action statement. And then finally, we have evidence of implementation files. Now, this is the space where you are going to attach the evidence that you are providing to support your correction and corrective action statements. Now, CARA only supports the upload of JPEG and PDF files. Now, if you have other evidence types, if you have Word files, Excel files, PowerPoints, etc., that you can't upload to CARA, these can be provided to your auditor via email or through other appropriate means. Now, again, please note that you need to describe these things within the evidence of implementation field. So you need to tell us what your evidence is, and that evidence then also needs to be either attached or emailed separately to the auditor, one or the other, or some combination of the two. Now, the final fields that are provided within CARA give you a space to provide verification of effective implementation of your response. Now, this should be treated in the same way as you would treat a verification of an internal corrective action. What did you do to verify that the corrective action was fully implemented and effective? And again, there is a field for providing related evidence of this activity, and that field is again optional. Now, after you have inputted all of the required information, at the bottom of the page, you're going to click the Save NCs for Auditor field, and that's going to generate a new JSON file, and that JSON file is going to be sent back to the auditor for their review and approval. Now, we recommend that you also use the print report feature to output a PDF file for your own records. Now, as you're doing this, be certain that you are looking for the mandatory fields as you're filling in your response. Now, these have to have content filled in, and the way you'll know what they are is you'll spot a red outline box. If you go up and down the page when you're filling in your response and you are seeing a red outline box, that means that you have not provided one or more pieces of required information. So you need to figure out what the report's asking you to provide and provide that information. Now, if the auditor or the veto reviewer, someone like myself, finds an issue with one or more of the responses that you have provided, these are going to be outlined via the reviewer comments field. I've shown an example of what this looks like below. Now, those comments will be shared with you through an updated JSON file prepared through the same process that we just discussed. Now, after all responses have been fully reviewed and approved, you will get a finalized JSON file showing the approval for your records and a PDF file as well. Now, some of our clients have been asking if they can still use their own format for recording responses. In the past, you were able to do that for nonconformances that were prepared within PJR's workbook. Unfortunately, now that the format belongs to the ITF itself, they're being very firm that you can certainly use your own internal format to develop your response, but in terms of submitting your response, it must be done via the CARA application. Now, there are several resources available to you to try to walk you through this process if it's going to be your first time. To begin with, the ITF has a wiki information page. There's even a tutorial video that you'll find on that page. So I've provided the URL for that wiki page here below. In addition, I've personally created two training videos that walk the viewer through the basic steps of interfacing with CARA. Now those can be found at the following URL. So if you want to do a screenshot of this page here, you can visit those URLs and learn a little bit more about interfacing with CARA. I'll leave the screen up here for just a couple of extra seconds for anyone that wants to do that. So let's move on now to remote auditing. Policies on ITF remote auditing, where do these come from? Well, the ITF has maintained a document throughout the pandemic entitled the ITF Global Waivers and Measures in Response to the Coronavirus Pandemic. Now, that document is public domain. Anybody can get their hands on it. It's available at the ITF website, itfglobaloversight.org. And I will be referring to that document extensively throughout our presentation as the IETF COVID memo. Now, you're probably wondering why it took so long for IETF to come around and allow remote auditing. The automotive industry was, to be blunt about it, the automotive industry was stubborn, and they held out on remote auditing longer than any other industry. They felt that remote auditing techniques would not constitute an effective audit and treated them with suspicion. It was not until October of 2020, under increasing pressure from various interested parties, the ITF finally changed their collective stance and announced that remote audits would be accepted. So who can qualify for a remote audit? Well, per the COVID memo, the only justification for an audit converting from on-site to remote is if it is demonstrably evident that a regular on-site audit will not be possible for reasons directly linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. So what do they mean by that? Well, if there is a government-mandated lockdown in which persons are not permitted to work outside of the home or engage in non-essential travel, if an organization has a no-visitors policy out of an abundance of concern for their staff, these are examples of situations where the audit, on-site audit, is simply not possible, and it's tied directly to the pandemic. Now, if you fall into that category and you want to request a remote audit, The first thing that you need to do is contact your PJR scheduler and explain your reasoning. You will be sent a form entitled the F108 ICT IETF. This is the IETF remote audit questionnaire. It is that questionnaire has been formatted to make sure that PJR meets all of the requirements found in the COVID memo. Also, it's intended to help PJR do an effective job of planning for the remote audit. Section 1.2 of the COVID memo says that we have to have a documented agreement between ourselves and our client with regard to the remote audit. So this is part and parcel of making sure that we meet that requirement. So let's go ahead and take a look now at what is found in that F108 ICT IETF document. Now, the opening questions of the F108 ICT IETF, they talk about the technical aspects of how the remote audit is going to be facilitated. We start with software. Now, PJR has licenses, numerous licenses, for GoToMeeting, and we can offer GoToMeeting to any client that wants it for a remote audit. Now, if there are alternative software formats, Microsoft Teams, Skype for Business, Google Meet, and so forth, these are certainly permitted. But if you choose to utilize those alternatives, you are going to be wholly responsible for ensuring their successful utilization. The hardware aspects are also discussed. Now, remember, with hardware, we're talking computers, cell phones, body cameras, and so forth. You need to think in terms of both the production area and the non-production area, the administrative areas of your business. Remember that in an IETF audit, we always look at production. That's mandatory. And that doesn't change just because we're going to be doing the audit remotely. So when you fill in your response on hardware, you need to make sure that you're specifying what the hardware is going to be, both for the admin and for the office portions of the audit. Bear in mind also that you need to have sufficient Wi-Fi and or cell signal coverage for auditor real-time auditing in the production areas. So the office areas and the production areas are going to be looked at just like they would be in an on-site audit. Question two of the F108 ICT IETF asks about your ability to support a remote audit. Essentially, are all or at least most of your records in an electronic state so that it's seamless to review them in a remote setting? Now, we do have certain flexibility in that records can be scanned, but these must be as requested by the auditor. You cannot pre-screen or pre-select the evidence that the auditor is going to look at. It needs to be upon auditor request. So we've had, some clients will come to us and they'll say, well, some of these records, say inspection records, are hard copy, but we've got the ability to scan them and have them in the auditor's hands in 2 or 3 minutes. That's fine. That's absolutely fine if that is the arrangement. Question three asked if you're going to be actively manufacturing your product during the audit. Again, production is mandatory. So if you are shut down, that is going to be a concern. We're going to need to know about that here at headquarters. And in almost all likelihood, we are going to be rescheduling your audit. Now, questions 5 through 10 all pertain to gathering critical information so that we can make sure the audit time is going to be sufficient to review these items. So what are these items? Let's go over these items. Questions 5 through 7 pertain to situations where you had a shutdown. We need to know how long you were shut down, when you were shut down, And when you came back online, did you follow specific startup verification plans? Were there risks that you identified in resuming operations and so forth? This is going to help the auditor plan some of their time in what they're going to be looking at. Question A talks about extraordinary measures that were taken. Did you have to outsource your manufacturing, for example? Our auditor may need to review the arrangements that you made and that you secured customer approvals in those cases. Question 9 talks about resources. Did you lose resources, either temporarily or permanently? We may need to review the impact that had on your scorecards, your KPIs, and so forth. Question 10 talks about changes that have been made to your day-to-day processes, any new safety protocols that you've established, cleaning times, things of that nature. Question 11 requires you to appoint an audit coordinator. This is a specific designation from the COVID memo, and it reads as follows. The coordinator manages connections, auditee availability, and technical issues throughout the entire audit. It may be necessary to have more than one coordinator, especially if there is more than one auditor, with parallel audits being done simultaneously. The COVID memo gives a little bit of further clarification. The CB shall ensure that audit team members maintain full control of the audit steps and discussion to ensure the coordinator is not responding for the auditees. In general, you can think of the coordinator as the auditor's guide, just like if they were there on site, and therefore subject to all the same bylaws that are applied to guides, both by the ITF and ISO 17021-1 standard. Question 12 asks if you are willing to participate in a technology test session. This is yet another item that is mandated by the COVID memo. It states that a technology test session needs to be performed between the client and audit team prior to the audit. Now, this next part is key. For all technology types to be used in all environments, facilities, and locations planned for the audit, including all areas of the manufacturing floor. The technology test session must include a short mock audit session for each environment to test the operation and effectiveness of the remote audit. Now, you'll note that the technology test session is being done between the client and the audit team, not the client and PJR. Obviously, we're not doing the audit ourselves. So for us to test the technology would not be value added for planning out the audit. Now, the final portion of the F108 ICT IETF gives you a place to provide a listing of your automotive customers and to let us know if they're operational or not. And again, this is geared towards appropriate audit planning. Now, there's two elements that are mentioned in the F108 ICT IETF that we should spend a few additional minutes on. Let's start with the audit coordinator. Now, remember that this party should be reasonably versed in the technical aspects of the remote interface to help facilitate the audit process. So they should know what they're doing with the hardware, with the software. But bear in mind that they cannot interject themselves into the interviews or attempt to select the audit samples on the auditor's behalf. The auditor maintains control of the audit at all times. And also, obviously, the technology test session. This needs to cover all support areas, all production areas, all administrative areas, all technology types, and testing of the backups. Basically, we need to have reasonable assurance that the remote audit will be successful. Also, bear in mind that the technology test session occurs outside of the actual audit process, days before, in most cases. Now, what happens if some part of the remote audit doesn't work? If we lose the connection, that sort of thing. Well, the COVID memo establishes that any part of the remote audit that cannot be successfully completed as planned must be added to a subsequent audit. So here's what PJR has done with that requirement. If the remote audit in question is a surveillance audit, we are going to add time to the next audit, and that'll be sent to you obviously in amendment format. Now, if on the other hand, the remote audit is a stage two or a recertification audit, in most cases, we're going to have to perform a second supplemental assessment to make up the difference in lost audit time. Audit time is mandatory within the ITF rules. So unfortunately, we do have to make sure that the audit time requirements are being met. Now, if you are not comfortable with remote audit or you're in a position where you can't support it, now the prior versions of the COVID memo did have some provisions for delaying the audit. Unfortunately, those provisions are no longer available in the current version of the memo. The ITF's position now is that you must perform your audit, whether on-site or virtually, and you must perform it on time. And if you don't, you will risk losing your certification. So if you are in a position where you've got a lot of hard copy records, but you just can't do the on-site audit, their expectation is that you are going to start working on transitioning your records to a virtual medium as part of your preparation for the audit. Now, I also want to assure you that PJR is a tenured provider of remote audits. We've been doing them for over a year now, essentially since the pandemic began. We have performed well in excess of 1,000 remote audits for a variety of schemes, including at this point, numerous audits for ITF. If you want to learn more about our remote audit process, you should definitely check out the Virtual Audits Explaining PJR's Approach and Expectations webinar. I'd like to invite you to tune in for one of our other webinars. We have important interaction of processes and its importance to a successful audit. That one is shown on a semi-annual basis. It includes an exploration of what processes are and how to correctly understand them. And we've got a wide variety of other webinar topics, stage one auditing, ISO 9001, ISO 14001, and so forth. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to visit our website at www.pjr.com, enter the email address in the space at the bottom of the page and click subscribe. You'll be opted in for future updates on new webinars, news updates on standards, and other points of information. I do thank you for your time. While I've got everyone's attention, we've been getting a certain amount of questions from our ITF clients on pending certificate expiries. I'd like to remind everyone that's joined us today that when the COVID memo was released last year, the ITF stated, among many other things, that all certificates were given a 6-month extension. So if you are up for certificate renewal this year, and you have a certificate that is expiring, say, the end of next week, June 25th, remember that your certificate was given a 6-month extension by the ITF itself. So hopefully that makes a few of you breathe a bit easier at the moment. I'll go ahead and unlock the question portion of the dashboard and see if we have any questions from our audience today. Okay, well, we appear to have no questions, so I'll thank all of you for your time, wishing you all the best, and thank you very much.